Hi, and welcome to Jolly's Fall 2020 podcast series. This is Yishuan Wan, the principal editor of the Journal of Language and Literacy Education, a peer-reviewed open access journal housed in the Department of Language and Literacy Education at the University of Georgia. Today, I'll be speaking with Dr. Griffin, a postdoctoral research fellow at the University of Pennsylvania. Her manuscript is titled Magic Water, the Symbolic and Healing Nature of Water in Black Children's Literature. Thank you so much for joining me today, Dr. Griffin, and I look forward to hearing more about your work. So before we start, could you please introduce yourself?
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me. It is a pleasure to be here with you today. So like you said, my name is Dr. Autumn Griffin, and I am a postdoctoral research fellow at the University of Pennsylvania on the Digital Discourse Grant, where we look at how teachers facilitate discourse online for students, specifically about literature, with the goals of equity and justice in mind. My research interests are around Black youth digital literacies and the ways that Black youth take up digital tools to kind of understand the world around them, around English education curricula and specifically humanizing English education curricula, and then children's and young adult literature.
Yeah, so I would like to talk more about your manuscript. And the first time I read your manuscript, I was absolutely amazed by this piece because it's so beautiful and very emotional. And I just feel like this kind of work is much needed at this time. And especially your journey to Ghana guided this piece. So the first question I have is, could you please walk us through the process of developing the metaphor of water in your article?
Yeah, so I think I should start by saying I've always been a writer. And like, even before I was an academic, I was a writer. I loved as a child writing creative short stories or poems. And my brain kind of works in metaphors. So I have a piece that came out at the top of this year called Black Parade, where I liken Black girls' multimodal renderings to parading practices, specifically parading practices in Black communities. I have another piece where I'm thinking about the ways that jazz is likened to anti-racist English pedagogy, right? And so my brain kind of just works in metaphors. I think this one in particular came in because I had spent some time in Ghana for a study abroad program. And I've always also really loved water. It is just a part of who I am. I am a Pisces. My grandmother reminds me of that often. Love to spend time like in pools and in lakes or even surrounded by them. And so one of the things that kept resonating with me as I was in Ghana was the water, not only the instance that I talked about in the piece, but also there was a point in time where I remember standing on the side of, I cannot remember which castle, I think it was Cape Coast Castle we were in, and looking over the side and feeling like the water was trying to devour this castle or this historical landmark that held so much pain and trauma. And so the water kept coming up for me the entire time I was in Ghana. And I've also for a long time been a journaler. And so I remember going back to my journal to read what I had written and noticing that that was the theme that kept coming up. But also that as I was reading children's literature, there were these constant themes, especially in Black children's lit, of water that were playing out time and time again. And so it just felt like a natural transition to kind of talk about both water and children's literature, Black children's literature in particular, together.
Yeah, thank you so much for sharing how you developed this metaphor and also your writing techniques like journaling. I think those are all great techniques for all writers, basically. And your trip to Ghana specifically reminds me of the documentary called High on Hogs, when Stephen Satterfield went to also a point where the enslaved people start their voyage to the United States. And I kind of sense that in your article as well. And I'm just curious about this very unique transnational experience you had, because you mentioned it was almost like going home, but it's actually a new place you've never been to. So my next question is, based on your transnational experience to Ghana, how did you understand ancestry and home after your trip?
Yeah, so Ghana was not my first time going to the continent of Africa. I went in undergrad. I studied abroad in Cape Town, South Africa for some time. And I remember then thinking I was home. And I should say that I no longer conceptualize the continent as my home. Like, I did not grow up there. And so I cannot in some ways claim it as home. There are cultures and practices and traditions and histories of which I'm unaware and disconnected from because of enslavement and because of the kidnapping that took place during the slave trade. So I think this time I was going with the understanding that Ghana is not my home. It is the home, perhaps, and I don't know because this was robbed from me, but it is perhaps the home of some of my ancestors, right? It is West Africa is where my people came from. And so there was this instance of I recognize that I'm not going home, but I also recognize that a part of my history is in this place and that my ancestors may have traversed through these places. And so for me, it was a spiritual kind of journey. It was a journey to connect with some of those ancestral energies. I remember in the piece I talk about Asin Manso, and one of the things I didn't talk about was the walk from where we had parked to the river. And I remember on that river feeling ancestral energy in ways that I just had not been able to connect with it before. And it was so strong and so powerful. And there was so much pain in that place, but also there was rejoicing in that, like, oh, our lineage is coming back to this place where we were torn from, in a seat of power to some extent, right? In a seat of like exploration and education in ways that like my ancestors were unable to because they were robbed of that humanity and dignity. And so it wasn't a returning home in the same way that I was tricked into believing it was when I was an undergrad, but it was a deepening of my knowledge, of my connection to my history, and a deepening of my connection with the past.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that. And you just mentioned many emotions, as well as in your article, like trauma, discomfort, peace, and awakening. And these are very intense emotions, high emotions. And in your article, I can see it took you a while to kind of figure out these feelings and emotions. So my next question is, are there any suggestions for students and scholars who also do works with high emotions, either writing process or other suggestions?
This is such a beautiful question. So I cried during this piece while I was writing it. And this draft that is coming out is not the original that I wrote. That was much more like a journal. It's something that feels much more personal. And there are some scholarly aspects to this, but throughout each iteration of this piece, I allowed myself to cry, to return to those emotions. I pulled out old journals, like I mentioned. I think for scholars working with such tough emotions, it's a process of vulnerability. We have to be willing to allow ourselves to feel the things, because the society that we live in often tells us that it's brain first and heart second. And I think when we allow ourselves to lead with our heart, that we can really come to some beautiful, not only reflection, but perhaps restoration. So I think first and foremost, I would tell folks to allow themselves to feel what comes up. That's especially important as we're writing for folks that work with kids and think about childhood trauma, for folks that are maybe reading pieces that deal with trauma. I would also encourage folks to lean into whatever spiritual practice is their own. And so for me, I was raised in the Black church. And so my faith has always been very important to me. Over time, it has shifted, and I'm working to really decolonize my faith now, right? But part of that means I am engaging in practices of breath work. It means that sometimes I allow myself to just dance in the middle of the room to let out whatever needs to get out. It means that sometimes there's prayer as I'm working through a piece. And sometimes journaling is a method of praying for me to get out what it is I'm thinking through. So I would definitely say lean into whatever your chosen spiritual practice is, allow spirit to come into the work. And then the last thing is to think about who your audience is for and like what you would have wanted to read or what folks might need. It does no one a service if I am holding back or if I'm not allowing myself to be vulnerable. I think one of the things that what people have told me is most compelling about my work is that it is not only relatable, but that I allow myself to go there with my emotions and my readers feel that. And so I think that often we can hide some of that in our work, but we never know who this work is going to connect with. So those are the three things, like be authentic to yourself, I think. But those are the three things that I would recommend.
Yeah, thank you so much. I think these are really great suggestions. And I think it was such a great point you said. Usually people think about brain first and heart second, but the connection that might have with the audience is really long-term and invaluable. So yeah, thank you so much for that answer. And my next question is, according to your research, could you please share what teaching and learning can lead to if educators put healing and care at the center of their teaching pedagogies and practices? Because I think your article definitely touched on that. So could you please share more?
Yes. Oh my goodness. We'd have a totally different world if we would lean into the healing and care practices in our work. I think that first and foremost, the children we work with and for deserve our care and our love. And so Yolanda Seeley Ruiz has some amazing work on archaeology of the self that really encourages us to go inward and to focus on who we are, what our biases are, our experiences, what we value. And I think to begin, that is the place to start to do some critical reflection of self. And I think when educators do that, and not only educators, researchers too, when we do that work, we're able to more authentically connect with communities to create long-term change for what they need, what they're defining as their needs, and not what we're defining as their needs. So we're able to see the community or the vision for community that people have envisioned for themselves come to life. I think that we are able to heal from some of the historical wrongs that have been done. And that's not to say that that is only interpersonal. There's some systemic healing that also needs to happen, right? But it allows us to then heal inwardly so that we can work collectively. I think the learning, teaching and learning can lead to if educators put healing and care at the center. I think that it would allow us to have more joy, more space for joy in the classroom. We would discontinue or disrupt, I suppose, some of the curricular violence, the pedagogical violence that students are faced with in class. If we are humanizing each student and every person we work with, then we recognize that what we do has an impact, not just in the moment, but in a long-term sense. And that causes us to walk with just an ethic of care and love towards each individual we meet. Whereas if we're just doing this because of what we want to know or because of what we think we can publish, then we're missing the point. And so I love this idea of bringing healing and care to the center of teaching and research, because I believe it drives everything I do. And I think that, like I stated at the beginning, if more people did that, we would have just a completely different educational landscape.
Yeah, thank you so much for your answers. I just really loved your piece, and I'm so excited. We're going to publish it this issue. So thank you so much again, Dr. Griffin, for speaking with me today.
Thank you so much for having me. This has been a pleasure.
Yeah, thanks. Listeners, to read this manuscript, please check out Jolly's Fall 2021 issue to be published in December 2021.